I don't know if you're like that, Barb, but so many favourite lyrics, and it's so difficult to pick one or two of them.
I know, you can't stop when you start. You start thinking of things, and you think of a particular thing, like a story song, and then you go, oh, the child ballads, what about those? And yes. Then you think of, you know, plot-driven songs, which, of course, a lot of the musicals have got a lot of those plot-driving songs in there. And then you think of the things that aren't plot-driven, and before you've finished, it's Christmas.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about Cole Porter, then, Don. Can you pick out a line or two that show his genius?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, lyric writing is a very difficult thing. I once compared it with doing your own root canal work. And, you know, the object, you know, of a lyric writer is to try and to say something different about the human condition. Just say it in a different way. Now, Cole Porter was a master at this. I mean, you could say to somebody, I'm leaving, a very boring way, but Cole Porter says, every time we say goodbye, I die a little. And it's such a fresh way of saying it. And later on in the song, while the gods above me, who must be in the know, think so little of me, they allow you to go. I mean, it's just wonderful way of putting these things. And, you know, if I was in a restaurant and I heard someone at the next table saying to someone else, you've lost that loving feeling, I'd write it down. You know, you look for these little nuggets of saying something in a slightly different way.
Barb, how much do you think the job of a lyricist is to find a new way of saying something, well, simple, like I love you, or I don't love you, or you don't love me?
It's tricky, isn't it? Because I always think it's the first line. I think you've lost that loving feeling is a really interesting example, because you start with something and it spins you off. And even if it spins you in a wrong direction, you find you often come back to that first line. And if you take, as a for example, Tangled Up in Blue, it's such an early one morning, the sun was shining, I was laying in bed. It's just great, and it's iambic pentameter, and it's rhythm, and it's everything. Cole Porter, of course, played as well, so he's writing and hearing at the same time.
Yes, one of the few people who did words and music.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing, and I was thinking of Way to Bring Me Shad Row, because that's just glorious, isn't it? Way to Bring Me Shad Row, that's fantastic.
But, you know, we often talk about the greats, Irving Berlin and Cole Porter, Oscar Hammerstein. They are all geniuses. But there are also geniuses in the pop world, and people do sometimes look down on these songs, but if you take Jolene by Dolly Parton, I mean, it's quite brilliant, that line, please don't take him just because you can.
She's also a music writer. That's the other thing about Dolly Parton, is she does that. And of course, with Jolene, you get that fantastic thing of the Jolene, 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 which is so clever, completely repeated. You know, I mean, if you said that, it would just be pretty dull. But that thing of the lifting melody, which takes her right up and then dumps her again, Jolene, you know, she gives you everything. Everything in that.
Yes.
And she tells you so much about that woman without saying very much at all. And she tells you so much about herself. You know, your beauty is beyond compare with flaming locks of auburn hair. And I cannot compete with you, Jolene.
Yes.
She tells you everything there.
Yes.
I cannot compete with you, Jolene.
We're going to do a bit of practical criticism a bit later. But I once heard a tape of Charlie Chaplin composing at his own piano. He couldn't read music, so he just set the tape recorder. And played. And he sang the phrase, I'm so depressed, over and over again in lots of different ways. I mean, do you use placeholder lyrics when you work?
You know, there really is no formula. I've worked with over 150 composers. It's quite a lot, probably more than this audience. And, you know, from Quincy Jones to Andrew Lloyd Webber, John Barry, Henry Mancini. And funny enough, they are all different people, but they are exactly the same at the piano. They are all looking for that tune. And it's as simple as that. And it's really no great mystery to it. They're looking for that melody. I'm looking for that unusual lyric line. And no, I mean, with Andrew Lloyd Webber, he prefers to write the music first. Although every now and again, I give him a title. When I wrote Tell Me on a Sunday, I gave him that title, which he liked. And he wrote a song around that.
Mm.
And the same would take that look off your face from that show. And the same when I did Sunset Boulevard with him, I gave him As If We Never Said Goodbye from that show.
Again, that's lovely, As If We Never Said Goodbye. Again, it just, you can hear the music in those words straight away, and I think that's often a key, isn't it? If you go back to You've Lost That Loving Feeling,
yes.
The music's already there.
Yes.
Is one of the things that a lyricist has to deal with the comic power of rhyme? Because rhyme in poetry is often brings that effect with it, but I sense that somehow the lyricist has to work against that effect sometimes. So when you think about Tell Me on a Sunday, where you rhyme please with chimpanzees, in another context that would be funny, but within the context of that song, it isn't quite, is it?
No, well, the music dictates how the rhymes go, but rhymes are a great aid to the ear, and all these songs you're going to hear in the concert tonight by Irving Berlin and those people, they all rhyme. There is no impure rhymes. They are so well crafted. And that's changed a lot over the years.
It really has. But, you know, you think of something like Wichita Lineman, which Jimmy Webb was talking about recently. And he said he finds it so difficult because he has an impure line in the second verse. And I need you more than want you. And I want you for all time.
Yes, time.
But the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
Yes.
So he's rhymed time and line there. But and for him, that was a terrible thing. But of course, for us, when we hear it, we don't hear that at all. Because what we hear is, and I need you more than want you.
Yeah.
And I want you for all time. We're not concentrating on that. And it's a very interesting phenomenon, I think, the kind of the license that people took after Bob Dylan.
Yes.
And I do think Dylan was a kind of a starting point for that because he rhymed in such a renegade way. He rhymed like a poet. It doesn't mean that he was writing poetry, but he rhymed like a poet. He took that kind of liberty, which I think that those earlier writers, the great American songbook writers, would never have done.
Barb, you had a good example of the use of rhyme from Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, I love this so much. This is, such a fantastic song because it's plot-driving and it's character-establishing and it's funny and then it's painful. So you get that lovely, lovely verse. I'd see my wife, my Goldie, looking like a rich man's wife with a proper double chin, supervising meals to her heart's delight. I see her putting on airs and strutting like a peacock. Oh, what a happy mood she's in, screaming at the servants day and night. So you're establishing all that humour to get to Lord, who made the lion and the lamb, you decreed I should be what I am. Would it spoil some vast eternal plan if I were a wealthy man? And that's heartfelt. That's the thing that anybody who's not wealthy feels. So you've gone through all of that trickery, if you like, to get to a place where he just drives in a punch. It's fantastic.
Don, that song also has all those diddly diddly lums in it as well. Are they cheating?
No, that's a wonderful character. He's an illuminating character, which is what you're supposed to do when you write a musical.
Yes.
That's what it's all about. Sheldon Harnick is one of the great lyric writers. And also from that show is Sunrise Sunset, one of my favourite songs.
And that's
the
difference.
You talked about poetry just before. There's a big difference between poetry and lyric writing.
Can we define that difference?
Well, yeah, I think poetry, you can ponder poetry, you can read it in your own time, you can reread it, but with a song, it's instant. There's a tempo to it, there is a melody to it.
And you can't remember song lyrics without singing the song in your head. It's really difficult.
And some of the great poets have written very bad lyrics.
Well, it's difficult to set them because, of course, the whole thing about this is, as a singer, what you want is you want those nice open vowels on the big notes. You want those that to be there for you. And that's, again, the skill of the great American songbook writers is they're always giving you the vowels in the places where you need them.
Yeah. And also, lyrics are written to be sung. So when you read a lyric, it sounds very ordinary. It doesn't. One example comes from No No Nanette. And when I say these words, they mean very little, but you know the tune. Picture you upon my knee, just tea for two and two for tea. just me for you and you for me alone. Well, but when you hear it sung, you know, you get that goosebump.
Music is sort of like a body on which the clothes of the lyric hang, and that's not to make a preference for either thing there. But say, for example, the Great American Songbook always feels like it's wearing a suit, a very tailored suit. Mm-hmm. It's very properly dressed, that music, and the lyrics, they're very proper dressing for that. And the minute you get to something like, for example, Dylan, there's a pair of sneakers on, you know, and there's a little bit of a jacket slung over a shoulder, because there's an ease to the way that the lyrics hang. So with Dylan, a lot of the work, it's almost like rap, tangled up in blues, like a rap almost, mm-hmm. because you've got that rhythm going. And then you get, early one morning the sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed at all, if her hair was still red. And there's not really an awful lot of tune going on, but the drive of it, that rhythmic drive, hangs those words really tightly, actually.
Does it matter, Don, if a singer doesn't fully understand a lyric or a song?
You know, I've worked a lot over the years with people like Shirley Bassey, and Johnny Mathis and Tony Bennett. And these are people who are not that articulate. I mean this in the nicest possible. They're not actors. But when they sing, they inhabit the character. And they're great storytellers. It's when the music starts, they take on this persona. It is surprising how moved you can get when Tony Bennett sings a ballad.
Oh, yes.
And yet he's not the most talkative when you meet him afterwards.
did you have to take on, to an extent, that Bassey persona when you wrote Diamonds Are Forever, with Goldfinger, I suppose, being kind of on the record already?
Well, Diamonds Are Forever, I mean, there's a lot of luck goes into songs when you write songs. Diamonds Are Forever, the producer, Harry Saltzman, didn't like the lyric. He thought it was filthy. Touch it, stroke it, and undress it. You know, how can you do that? But the other producer, Cubby Broccoli, did like it, and it went through. And that's happened to me a couple of times. Born Free was a song that the producer, Carl Foreman, didn't like at all. He thought John Barry's melody was a bit soupy and syrupy, and he thought my lyric was more of a social comment. He wanted it about cages and lions. The next time I saw Carl Foreman, though, was at the Academy Awards, when Dean Martin gave me the Oscar, and Carl Foreman put his arm around me and said, "Well, Don, it does grow on you."
Where do you stand on Born Free, Bob?
Well, you see, I'm going to do a little test now, if you might indulge me for a second. But I was in a car in Dorset, and somebody said, "What are you doing on Monday?" And I said, "Oh, I'm doing this," and Don Black. And they said, "Oh," and we went through things that Don had written, and I said, "Born Free." And without any seconds hesitation, "Can you do this? Born free as the wind blows, as free as the grass grows, you're free to follow your heart." No, see what you. I mean? That's fantastic.
Well done, everyone.
Thank you.
That's fantastic.
It's a shame Carl Foreman isn't here to hear
it. Isn't it? Isn't it just? He'd be eating his hat.
You mentioned the lyrics of Diamonds Are Forever. There's an unusual word in that, lustre, as a verb and not a noun. I was looking at that today, thinking, there's something odd about that. That's not something that everybody would put in there.
Well, I'm going to tell you a little story. I hope you don't mind a little bit of name-dropping, do you?
No, that's what we're here for, I think, isn't it?
Partly. Because I was having a meeting with Andrew Lloyd Webber in his New York apartment at the Trump Tower, and Steven Spielberg was there. And I'd never met Steven Spielberg. It's not bad name dropping. And Andrew introduced me, and just as I was going to say, "Oh my God, Steven," he said, "You're not the Don Black, are you?" and I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you wrote my favorite title song, Diamonds Are Forever." And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes, the way the translucence lighting of the word luster, the way it all came together." And, I mean, I just wrote the word. I had no idea, but he saw something in it.
But there is something, I mean, I think that that's, surely that's something that we can identify as like one of the secrets of great lyric writing. Mm-hmm. There is something highly unusual kind of seeded inside these things sometimes. Yeah. But there's also songs that are written in unusual tenses or with unusual grammar in them. ABBA's The Day Before You Came, is a brilliant example of this. There's something absolutely bizarre about that song in that it's about somebody's happiness, but it's all in this modal, kind of grammatical form. I must have gone to bed around 10:15. I need a lot of sleep, and so I like to be in bed by then. I must have read a while the latest one by Marilyn French or something in that style.
Yeah, you see, I love to.
I mean, I've just written a song.
Take that look off your face. That's such a great starting point. Take that look off your face. It's fabulous.
Take that look off your face. There's also a line in that that probably isn't grammatically right. Well, I'm sure it isn't. But it's right for that character to sing. She sings, take that look off your face. I can see by your smile. You would love to be right. Mm. I bet you didn't sleep good last night. Well, yeah. Didn't sleep good last night. I don't think Stephen Fry would be happy with that.
But he's not known for his great songs, is he?
No, he's not. What about the place of narrative in song, Bob?
I wanted to speak about Dolly Parton again, because she's so good at narrative. She's absolutely wonderful. And one of the things that I wanted to surprise Don with was this song, Dover, which has a beautiful first verse. And I won't sing it, I'll just read it to you. I know this dress I'm wearing doesn't hide the secret I have tried concealing. When he left, he promised me that he'd be back by the time it was revealing. The sun behind a cloud just casts the crawling shadow o'er the fields of clover. And time is running out for me. I wish that he would hurry down from Dover. And slowly, slowly, with a very simple balladic form, she ramps up the ante on each verse and key changes up and key changes up until we get to the truth, which is that she's pregnant. She's pregnant. She was probably not very smart. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks she's an idiot. She keeps saying, he's coming back from Dover. He's coming back. Against all the odds, she believes this. And you just can see her in her Dust Bowl dress. You can see everything. And you get to the last verse, which is, my body aches, the time is here. It's lonely in this place where I am lying. Our baby has been born, but something's wrong. It's much too still. I hear no crying. This is Dolly Parton. I guess in some strange way she knew she'd never have a father's arms to hold her. And dying was her way of telling me he wasn't coming up from Dover.
And that, I'm afraid, will have to be our closing number. So please give your thanks to Don Black and Barbie Younger.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Allegra McElroy. Petroc Trelawney with you here at the Royal Albert Hall, backstage, in fact, almost on the stage. I'm in the Bull Run, where musicians make their entrances onto the platform. It's the Broadway sound this Bank Holiday Monday evening with the John Wilson Orchestra in the spotlight. And with me right now, John Wilson.
Hello, Petroc.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You must be thrilled, because this has been months and months of listening and looking at scores and rejecting and accepting.
Months. I mean, the most challenging programme I've ever had to put together, because there are so many terrific scores to choose from. And my first draft ran to about 5 hours, so I had to whittle it down. And it was my 52nd draft that made it. And even today, we changed one of the pieces round to the end of the first half, so it settled eventually.
These were the days, as I was saying earlier on, when theatres had orchestra pits that were bursting at the seams.
Yeah, the most happy fella had 38 in the orchestra, 39 for Carousel. Routinely you'd have 20 unamplified musicians in the orchestra, nobody amplified on stage, acoustic. And it was that thrill of that, the human experience of hearing musicians and singers together in this repertoire. It's unequaled.
And the most wonderful orchestrations as well. I mean, there's not a wasted note, is there?
No, I think the Broadway orchestrators, their craft was their creed, you know, and they took the business of clothing these wonderful tunes by Porter and Gershwin and Kern in the best, richest possible manner.
This could run and run and run, couldn't it?
Well, I hope so. We try to take these things on tour, you know, once we've done them here at the Albert Hall in a slightly, but only slightly reduced format.
And a wonderful cast, some new faces and some old friends like Seth MacFarlane back again.
Yeah, it's very hard, as I've said in the past, to find singers for this sort of repertoire, but there ain't any better girls than Sierra Burgess and Anna Jane Casey. And we've got this year Elizabeth Llewellyn and Rodney Clark, who are doing wonderful things from Porgy and Bess. And of course, Julian is a stalwart of the proms. Now, Seth made his debut here in the MGM prom. And I just, you know, somebody said to me the other day in an interview, why do you have Seth? Because he's not a professional singer, he's a professional animator. But he sings all the time in his cartoon, and he sounds wonderful, and he's as authentic as all those guys from the 50s, and his voice fits the bill perfectly.
Your orchestra are on stage. We should let you go. Have a minute to gather your thoughts. John Wilson, thank you.
Nice to chat. Thanks.
We are then just a few seconds away from part two of the Broadway Sound. John Wilson will in just a few seconds walk out into a packed Royal Albert Hall. No surprise tonight, a hot ticket. It was 2009 that the John Wilson Orchestra made its first appearance here at the Proms. It's been back every year since, twice this year, first with My Fair Lady on the opening weekend of the season. Well, ahead in part two, a couple of appearances by Leonard Bernstein. There's Jerry Herman and Julie Stein, Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, Jerry Bock with a musical portrait of a much-loved New York mayor, two shows by Frank Lesser, and to start, Frederick Lowe collaborating with librettist Alan J. Lerner. Same team who created My Fair Lady. This time the money was on Arthurian legend. There were high hopes for Camelot, which opened in 1960. The show wasn't a complete success. Noel Coward famously called it Parsifal without the laughs. Well, we're going to start the second half of the concert this evening by marking the lusty month of May with Sierra Burgess and the Maida Vale Singers. To terrific cheers from the Royal Albert Hall audience, John Wilson returns to the stage to conduct the John Wilson Orchestra. Thank you.
that shocking time of year when tons of wicked little thoughts merrily appear. It's May, it's May, that gorgeous holiday when every maiden prays that her lad will be a cad. It's mad, it's gay, a libelous display. Those dreary vows that everyone takes, everyone breaks, everyone makes divine mistakes. The musty month of May. Whence this fragrance wafting through the air? What sweet feelings does it send transmute? Whence this perfume floating everywhere? Don't you know it's that dear forbidden fruit? Tra-la-la-la-la, that dear forbidden fruit. Tra-la-la-la-la.
It's true, I promise you.
You promise me this, you promise me that, you promise me everything under the sun, then you give me a kiss and you're grabbing your hat and you're off to the races again when I think of the time gone by.
Adelaide, Adelaide.
And I think of the way I tried.
Adelaide.
I could honestly die.
Call a lawyer and sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you. Give a holler and hate me, hate me. Go ahead, hate me.
The
I
best
love
years
you.
Of my life, I was a fool to give to
all
you.
All right already, I'm just a no good Nick. All right already, it's true, so new. So sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I
gamble it here, you gamble it there, you gamble on everything all except me, and I'm sick of you keeping me up in the air till you're back in the money again when I think of the time gone by.
Adelaide.
And I think of the way I tried.
Adelaide.
I could honestly die.
Serve a paper and sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you. Give a holler and hate me, hate me. Go ahead, hate me, I
when
love you.
When you wind up in jail, don't come to me to bail you
all
out.
All right already, so call a policeman. All right already, it's true. can you do me? I love you.
You're at it again, you're running the game, and I'm not gonna play second fiddle to that. And I'm sick and I'm tired of stalling around, and I'm telling you now that we're through. When I think of the time gone by, and I think of the way I tried, I could honestly die.
Sue me, shoot bullets through me. I love you.
Anna Jane Casey and Seth MacFarlane, and Sue Me from Guys and Dolls. Another Frank Lesser show next.
Like a perfumed woman, the wind blows in the bunkhouse. Like a perfumed woman, smelling of where she's been, smelling of Oregon cherries, or maybe Texas avocados, or maybe Arizona sugar beets. The wind blows in, and she sings to me, 'cause I'm one of her rambling kin. She sings Joey, 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 Joey. Joey, Joe, you've been too long in one place, and it's time to go, time to go. The harvest time's come and gone. That's what the wind sings to me. When the bunk I've been bunking in gets to feeling too soft and cozy, when the food they've been cooking me gets to tasting too good, when I've had all I want of the ladies in the neighborhood, she sings Joey, 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 Joey. One place, and it's time to go.
Seth MacFarlane as Joey in Frank Lesser's The Most Happy Fella. Now next, Three Sailors, 24 Hours in New York City, a colossus of American music theatre. Next, Leonard Bernstein on the town. Hershey Kay's arrangement of the ballet Imaginary Coney Island from Leonard Bernstein's On the Town. Now the Gershwins next, Porgy and Bess, Elizabeth Llewellyn and Rodney Earl Clark making their way onto the stage. But before we hear them sing, John Wilson brings the John Wilson Orchestra to their feet to take a bow here at the Royal Albert Hall. Change of score, and now the Gershwins.
Oh, and winter time.
Elizabeth Llewellyn and Rodney Earl Clark singing from Porgy and Bess. One X, the tale of a celebrated mayor of New York, Fiorello LaGuardia.
Mr. X, may we ask you a question? It's amazing, is it not, that the city pays you slightly less than $50 a week, yet you've purchased a private yacht?
I am positive, Your Honor, must be joking. Any working man can do what I have done. For a month or two, I simply gave up smoking. And I put my extra pennies one by one into a little tin box. A little tin box that a little tin key unlocks. There is nothing unorthodox about a little tin box.
About a little tin box.
About a little tin box.
In a little tin box. A little tin box that a little tin key unlocks.
There is honor and purity.
Lots of security in a little tin box.
Next witness.
Mr. Y, we've been told you don't feel well, and we know you've lost your voice. But we wonder how you managed on the salary you make to acquire a new Rolls Royce.
You're implying I'm a crook, and I say no, sir. There is nothing in my past I care to hide. I've been taking empty bottles to the grocer. And each nickel that I got was put aside
into a little tin box. A little tin box that a little tin key unlocks. There is nothing unorthodox about a little tin box.
About a little tin box.
About a little tin box.
In a little tin box. A little tin box. There's a cushion for life's old shocks.
There is faith, hope, and charity.
Hard-won prosperity. In a little tin box.
Next witness, take the stand.
Mr. Z, you're a junior official, and your income's rather low. Yet you've kept a dozen women in the very best hotels. Would you kindly explain how so?
I can see Your Honor doesn't pull his punches, and it seems a trifle fishy, I'll admit. But for one whole week I went without my lunches, and it mounted up, Your Honor, bit by bit.
Of Your Honor, bit by bit.
It's just a
little tin box. A little tin box that a little tin key unlocks. There is nothing unorthodox about a little tin box.
About a little tin.
About a little tin
Andrew Playfoot, Nigel Richards, David Coombs and Garth Bardsley singing Little Tin Box from Fiorello by Jerry Bock. Now Elizabeth Llewellyn returns to the stage next, sing from a rare thing, a miss by Richard Rodgers, Allegro. Come Home from Allegro, Rodgers and Hammerstein, show that hit Broadway in 1947, sung by Elizabeth Llewellyn. A great balcony scene next.
Maria! Maria! Shh! Maria!
Quiet!
Come down!
Paul!
Maria!
Please, if Bernardo...
He's at the dance, come down!
He will soon bring Anita home.
Just for a minute.
A minute is not enough.
For an hour, then.
I cannot.
Forever. Shh. Then I'm coming up.
Maria?
Momentito, mamá.
Maria. Maria.
Caerito.
Shh.
It is dangerous.
I'm not one of them.
You are. But to me, you are not. Just as I am one of them.
To me, you are
Maruca.
All...
Maruca!
Si, yo vengo, papá!
Maruca?
His pet name for me.
I like him. He will like me.
No. He is like Bernardo. Afraid. Imagine being afraid of you.
You see?
I see you.
See only me.
Only you. You're the only thing I see forever. In my eyes, in my words, and in everything I do. Nothing else but you, ever.
And there's nothing for me but Maria. Every sign that I see is Maria.
Tony, Tony.
Always you, every thought I'll ever know. Everywhere I go, you're there. Tall.
I'm not afraid.
They are strict with me, please.
Good night.
Buenas noches.
I love you.
Yes, yes. Hurry. Wait! When will I see you?
Tomorrow.
I work at the bridal shop. Come there.
At sundown.
Yes. Good night.
Good night.
Tony!
Shh!
Come to the back door.
See?
Tony! What does Tony stand for?
Anton.
Te adoro, Anton.
Te adoro, Maria.
Good night. Good night.
Sleep
well, and when you
tonight, from West Side Story by Leonard Bernstein, sung by Sierra Borges and Julian Ovenden. Well, next, Anna Jane Casey as the Ziegfeld Follies star Fanny Brice.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly, I've simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. At least I didn't fake it, hat, sir. I guess I didn't make it, but whether I'm the rose of sheer perfection or freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of the eye. Oh, I gotta fly once, I gotta try once, only can die once. All right, so, ooh, life is juicy, juicy, and you see I gotta have my bite, sir. Get ready for me, love, cause I'm a comer. I simply gotta march, my heart's a drummer. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. I'm gonna live and live now. Get what I want, I know how. One throw for the whole shebang. One roll, that bell will go clang. Mr. Osteen, here I am. I'll march my band out. I'll beat my drum. And if I'm found, your turn at bat, sir. At least I didn't fake it, hat, sir. I guess I didn't make it. Get ready for me, love, cause I'm a comer. I simply gotta march, my heart's a drummer. Nobody, no, nobody is gonna.
Don't rain on my parade. Anna Jane Casey singing from Funny Girl. by Julie Stein. We are nearly at the end of the Broadway sound here at the BBC Proms. Time for the finale. Let us celebrate MAME. Music by Jerry Herman.
Send your back.
does John Wilson do it. The John Wilson Orchestra proms get better and better. Jerry Herman, MAME, from the musical of the same name, arrangement by Philip J. Lang. The company take their bows. English National Opera star Elizabeth Llewellyn, Sheffield-born actor and singer Julian Ovenden, Sierra Bogues from Denver, Colorado, creator, animator, and voicer of Family Guy, Seth MacFarlane, Anna Jane Casey, British musical star whose career stretches from Cats to Chicago, and operatic bass baritone Rodney Earl Clark. And that last cheer for John Wilson himself as he brings his orchestra to their feet. You can hear that stamping from this capacity Royal Albert Hall crowd this bank holiday Monday evening. One flag flying this evening. No surprise, it's the Stars and Stripes being waved with energy in the midst of the arena. The principals and John Wilson bow once again. The passion of John Wilson to play this music and take it absolutely seriously is what makes these evenings so extraordinary. He wins over new audiences over and over again, bringing to light often long forgotten orchestrations that have lain in dusty cupboards at the back of shelves, orchestrations that highlight perfectly the sheer range of talent in the British orchestral scene. John Wilson returns again. His orchestra, of course, drawn from many of the British orchestras. He climbs to the rostrum and brings now to their feet, first of all, the brass woodwind players of the orchestra, saxophones, flutes, bassoons, the percussion section now. Horns. Trumpets. Trombones. Now the two pianists, wonderful to see two pianos in the midst of this, creating such flexibility and orchestration. The rhythm section, including double bass, percussion, banjo, guitar, harpist. Gonna go through this one by one, the drummer there. Violins. Violas, yes, you know what's coming. Cellos. And finally, the basses. The entire John Wilson Orchestra now on its feet, led this evening by Warren Zielinski. With the orchestra on its feet, I wonder, could there be more to come? Well, not quite yet, because John Wilson has left the stage. Cueing the stamping to begin once again. He returns to the platform, bringing with him, looking stunning in shimmering silver, Anna Jane Casey. Baton up.
Troubles away, you bounced a big check, your mom has the vapors. Tap your troubles away, your car had a wreck, They're serving you papers when you're the one that it always rains on. Simply try putting your Mary Janes on. Your boss just gave you the axe. There's years of back tax. You simply can't pay. With a sky full of crap always lands in your lap. Make a curtsy and tap your troubles away. Gets locked up. Tap your troubles away. You're fat as a horse. And finally you're knocked up. When you need something to turn your mind off, why not try tapping the poor behind off? Your boat goes over the falls. The plane you're on stalls. The pilot yells pray. If you're
Tap dancing on the radio has a long and venerable history. 14 dancers in black tails and top hats tapping their way to the hearts of the audience.
When the wolf's at your door, there's a bluebird in store. If you glide across the floor, till your ankles soar.
From Jerry Herman's celebration of the silent movie era, the glory days of the Keystone Cops in Mac and Mabel, Tap All Your Troubles Away, sung by Anna Jane Casey with the John Wilson Orchestra and 14 tap dancers, who you will be able to see for yourself when the prom is broadcast on television, Saturday evening, 7:30, on BBC Two if you want to relive the excitement of tonight. The six soloists back on the platform: Elizabeth Llewellyn, Julian Avenden, Sarah Bogues, Seth MacFarlane, Anna Jane Casey, and Rodney Earl Clark. The John Wilson Orchestra stand to take a bow. And providing such a key role in this evening's concert, the Maida Vale Singers. Chorus Master Christopher Dee, standouts Andrew Playfoot, Nigel Richards, David Coombs, Garth Bardsley, Lindsay Benson, Heather Cairncross, and Catherine Jenkin. That is it. What a night we've had at the Royal Albert Hall. One to relive many times, I think. The top hats are still on, but I think that's it. Good night from here. Back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House. Tap shoes, shined, and ready to go.
Thanks very much, Petrock. Petrock Trelawney there at the Royal Albert Hall. An evening to remember, and if you want to experience it all over again on the radio, so to speak, there is, of course, the iPlayer for listening online anytime you like over the next 7 days. And we're back live at the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom tomorrow evening. Robin Ticciati conducting Glyndebourne Festival Opera's production of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro that starts here on BBC Radio 3, home of the proms, at 6:30 tomorrow evening.
On BBC Radio 3, a third week of concerts from the 2012 Edinburgh International Festival. Each weekday morning from 11, Monday to Friday, we have live performances from Edinburgh's Queen's Hall, featuring two hot piano properties, Francesco Piemontesi and Lear Williams. We have song recitals by the German baritone Dietrich Henschel and British tenor Toby Spence. And to finish the week, the energetic sound of the all-standing and outstanding Australian Chamber Orchestra. Weekday mornings from the 2012 Edinburgh Festival on Radio 3 from 11 o'clock.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10:30. And now Norman Lebrecht with the Lebrecht interview.
Riccardo Muti has been at the summit of his profession for 40 years, ever since he rescued a floundering Philharmonia orchestra in London. He went on to become music director in Philadelphia for 12 years and at La Scala for almost 20. In 2010, he took charge of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, restoring its reputation for powerhouse playing. It will be, he said, the last commitment of my life. Born in Naples 71 years ago, Riccardo Muti studied at the Verdi Conservatory and won a competition named after the short-lived Guido Cantelli. At 27, he was made principal conductor of the Maggio Musicale in Florence. Many of his activities have been turbulent, with the singular exception of a sunny 40-year relationship with the Salzburg Festival and the Vienna Philharmonic. Elegant, erudite, occasionally explosive, Riccardo Muti is the most passionate devotee of textual accuracy since, perhaps, Arturo Toscanini. For much of his life, he has been media shy. This is his first full-length interview for the BBC. We meet in his house in Arnif, outside Salzburg, a few days before a performance. Riccardo Muti, Arnif was where Herbert von Karajan lived. Is that the connection?
There is no direct connection with the fact that Karajan had a house here. But, of course, many people started to think, people are so nice. They thought, he bought the house here because maybe he wants for the future be in charge of the festival, or he wants to be connected with Karajan. All kind of legends. No, it's just because we like the place. I've been here for several decades, but it's just a very simple, normal human reason.
Tell me about Karajan when you first met him, because 1971 he was at the height of his imperium, yes, of his power, and you were a young Italian conductor just coming onto the scene. How was that relationship?
In fact, when I was invited, when I received the invitation, I thought that was a mistake. I was sure that was a mistake. I said, maybe they wrote to me, but they mean another conductor. Because despite the fact that people think that I am arrogant, I am actually quite shy and I would not say modest, but I know what I can do and what I cannot do. He heard that I was this Italian young conductor with some talent. And so he invited me to do Don Pasquale, an Italian, 1971. And I remember that I took the train during the night. At that time, I had not the money to for an airplane, this and that. So, and the salary in the Maggio Musicale was very cheap. Not today. Today it's another world. I don't mean about myself, generally. And so I took a taxi, and the taxi arrived late. And my first meeting with the Vienna Philharmonic was with half of the orchestra outside the Sovienzele waiting for the conductor. So I thought, oh, this is going to be a disaster. But we started immediately to have a wonderful relationship, musical relationship. But I didn't meet Karajan practically for 10 years. In 1979, I was making my last tour with the Philharmonia Orchestra of London, and the tour was in America, in North America. When we do these big tours, we not only play in New York, in Boston, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, but we go also to smaller places, less important places. And I remember that one concert took place in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Raleigh, North Carolina.
And so I did the concert and in this strange hotel, very strange hotel. Was not a luxurious hotel. And I was with my wife, and the next morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, the telephone rang. Two calls at 7 o'clock in the morning. The telephone was ringing. And so at a certain point, I had to answer. So I took the telephone, and I said in a very upset way, angry, I said, pronto. And from the other part, I hear, sono Karajan. And then I said to my wife, smiling, there is an idiot here that says that this Karajan. What kind of joke is this? And then I said, ha, ha, ha. And then he said, sono Karajan. Then I said, oh. I said, maestro, see? But how could you find me? And he said in Italian, se uno vuole trovare una persona, la trova. If you want to find a person, you find him. And then he said, have you ever conducted Così fan tutte? And I said, no. He said, I would like you to conduct Così fan tutte. I said, maestro, Così fan tutte is the most problematic opera of Mozart. And to try for the first time Così fan tutte in Salzburg, for me, young Italian conductor, and to conduct Così fan tutte means to be killed. And he answered, si or no? So I say, yes. So I even didn't know the opera. So I accepted. And so I took some singers that had already worked with me, etc., etc. The designer was Italian. And so I felt, in a way, at home. After the success of Così fan tutte, I met Karajan. Many of my colleagues, they were much closer to Karajan. They met him, they spoke to him. I was always distant, but not for arrogance, because I didn't want to bother. I didn't want to feel like somebody that is praying, asking for something.
You didn't want to be a supplicant?
Sí, un supplicante. Some people made comments about the fact that, because Karajan many times asked, well, why Muti never shows up? That's the reason why I always separate but the rest of the musical world. Still now, I feel like an outsider in the musical world because I conduct, I do my rehearsals, I do my concerts, and I disappear.
And you don't want any part of the gossip?
No, I don't want no parties, no congregations, no niente, absolutely. I was born normal, and I want to die, hopefully, normal, in my mind.
Tell me about your normal upbringing. Your father was a family doctor.
Sì, my father was a medical doctor. Yeah. And very good doctor, with a fantastic voice of tenor. And he was from Molfetta, that is on the Adriatic.
In Apulia?
Puglia,
yeah.
25 kilometers north of Bari. Mm-hmm. And his father, that is my grandfather, I remember when he was old, he used to sing arias from Poliuto, or Attila, or for Norma. I still have in my head his voice when he used to sing In mia mano al fin tu sei, in mia mano al fin tu sei, and he had this intensity, and that was the tradition, Italian tradition, that is still in the musical bands that you find in the south of Italy, when during special festivities the band plays the arrangements from operas. In those performances you realize the tradition of the 19th century, how operas were played without the eccentricities of this singer or that singer. So you have a duetto of Rigoletto from Gilda and Rigoletto, played by the cornetta, the little trumpet, and the bombardino, that is the little tuba. The little tuba plays the part of Rigoletto, and the cornetta plays the part of Gilda, with all the virtuosismi, all the agilities. Mm. That is the tradition in Italy.
How did your father go to visit his patients? Did he have a car? Did he go by bicycle?
He had a horse with a carriage.
And you went with him?
Sometimes. The image that I have in my mind is my father in 1946, 45, 46, with a white doctor's coat and with the gun here, because it was the 45, still the war. And
so he had a pistol in his waistband.
Under the doctor's coat, he was dressed like a soldier. Mm-hmm. Because he was a tenant, mm-hmm.
lieutenant.
And I remember this image, but very fragile image. 6th of December, we in the south of Italy, we received gifts from Christmas, etc., Father Christmas, etc. And so I received as a gift, unfortunately at that moment, a violin. So for me it was a punishment, and I rejected practically this idea. So my father one day said to my mother, I think that the boy is completely non-musical, so we should give up, etc. And my mother, that was not interested really in music like my father, said one phrase that I still remember now: let's try one more month. I don't know why my mother said this phrase, because for her, the fact that we studied music or not wouldn't make a big difference. But she said, let's try one more month. That phrase and that month changed. I don't know why. Suddenly, I started to understand the system of our reading the notes. In the violin, I made big progress with the violin. And in 1 year, I was able to play in front of the public in Molfetta a Vivaldi concerto.
And you were how old?
8 years old. And then after 2 years, I started to play also the piano.
Let me just ask you about your mother, because you tell a very interesting story about her in the memoir that was published last year. That when you started to get engagements as a conductor after you'd won the Cantelli competition, she would attend with the family, and she would tell the family not to applaud.
Ah, sì, certo. Was forbidden. And I remember I did the first concert, as a winner of the Cantelli competition in Novara. Novara is the city where Cantelli was born. So the winner had to conduct a concert in Novara. And there is a picture with the Teatro Coccia in Novara, where the young Toscanini had conducted several times. And you can see the public, and in the middle of the hall, my mother, my father, and some of my brothers, and everybody is applauding, and they are with their hands down. My father wanted to applaud because he was a very hot temperament. Always he was a singer and this and that. He would sing even when somebody was dying of his clients, just to give the impression that life was still there. I mean, it was a very, not eccentric and not superficial. He was a great doctor, but full of generosity. And so for him to have the son conducting and to be obliged to stay still, not to move, because my mother had a, she was a Neapolitan, but very strong. And my father was not weak, but just my father, my mother was very strong. And she said, it's too obvious that the parents and the relatives should and would applaud the son. Non facciamo brutta figura, she said. So don't
cut a crude figure.
Yeah, in front of the others. We should be neutral. And then when I started in Florence as a music director, she never applauded. She let other people to react in a positive or negative way. And I remember that in 1971, she came as the year where, when she died in September. She came in May in Florence for the Maggio Musicale, and I was conducting L'Africana, African, Maya Bell. And she came, and there was the critic of Florence, Leonardo Pinzauti, that was one of the major critics in now it must be 85, six years old. And so my mother came, and after the performance, she was introduced to the critic, and she said, "E mi dica come va questo ragazzo? Please tell me how this boy is doing." I come from this kind of education.
When you went to the conservatorio in Napoli, one day the director says to you, "Conduct." It was like that, wasn't it? You were playing.
See, I went to the conservatorio, and the usher came and said, "Muti, the director wants you in his office." So I was sure that he wanted to tell me, "You come regularly to the lessons, or you are out." At that time, discipline was so. I was like a soldier, standing. He was sitting there with a big picture of Martucci, big picture of Cilea, so the great Neapolitan, fantastic office in the old Conservatorio of Napoli. So he was sitting there, and I was standing, and he said to me, "Muti, hai mai pensato di dirigere? Have you ever thought to conduct?" For me, it's the last thing that I would have expected, this kind of question. And I said, "No." And he said, "You know, I heard you playing, and the way you played the piano, I think that you have the mentality, the mind of a conductor. From the way you play, your concept of sound is more symphonic than pianistic. You should try." So I met him. He took the score, opened the score, and he said, "The right hand gives the rhythm, and generally, the left hand should be interested more in the expression. With the left hand, you have to use it for expression." Then I started, and the first 2-3 minutes, I felt like somebody that had a rheumatic problem. And then suddenly, the hand became free. And I started to think that that was interesting, because I was doing nothing and they were playing. So that was fantastic. They were making gestures, and I felt very, very happy, very good, very comfortable. In that moment, I was told that the teacher called by telephone the director of the conservatory and said, "A new conductor is born." And so that was the beginning. And I studied composition, started in Napoli, and I finished in Milano with the highest vote in composition. And the course of composition in Italy is 10 years.
Harmony. Twice as long as the doctor.
Si. Every time I see a young conductor and says, I'm studying conducting, I said, you don't study conducting. Who taught Toscanini or Thomas Beecham or Karajan how to conduct? You have to study music. And today, this is one of the problems, especially in America, and comes from America. People study conducting. My teacher, that was Antonino Votto, the first assistant of Toscanini and La Scala, said to me and said to all the pupils, remember, the hands are only an extension of your mind. How to start the Brahms Fourth Symphony, I cannot teach you. In fact, if you see Kleiber conducted, starting this, he makes a gesture, they say, you don't know. Well, that doesn't belong to any book of conducting. If you have the music inside, you don't need to go to have course. This is the new system. They study conducting, the gestures, but they don't study music. And this is one of the problems also of the opera conductors. One time, the conductors came from the opera world, and they knew everything about operas, including the life that is backstage. They knew even the dust that is backstage. Today, there is the tendency, you conduct three Mozart symphonies or a Schubert symphony, and then you conduct Bohème. And the poor singers now, they say many times, say, we don't receive any suggestion, any work from the conductors today. One time, an opera was in the hands of the conductor that worked for weeks and weeks. I did Otello in 2001 in La Scala. Otello was Placido Domingo. And Domingo had sung at that time more than 300 performances of Otello. He was with me 3 weeks, re-studying the opera. Not because he needed to learn the opera, because it was another approach. And because Placido is a musician, he found it was very interesting to work again with a different view. That is what should be. But many times today, the singer arrives, they arrive 2 days before the premiere, 3 days before the premiere, they don't need rehearsals.
You're describing, Riccardo, a much broader issue, which is the erosion of educational methods and educational values. And you speak quite nostalgically of the tough teachers that you had. And you talk of yourself, of your notorious obduracy, that one needs to restore some rigor to music.
It's an ethical, not only artistic approach. It's an ethical approach to our work that is disappearing. And this is can be really a disaster, can be very, very, very serious problem. In fact, this is one of the reasons why directors are becoming more and more and more and more important. I mean, the stage directors are important. I'm not saying I have done operas with Strehler, with Ronconi, with Graham Vick, with Vitesse, etc., 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 with Jürgen Flimm, but more and more the directors become important because less and less the conductors are...
Because the conductors don't have the confidence to challenge them?
I make an example now. Verdi, with this music, he tells you who is the personaggio on stage. For example, Traviata, second act, Papa Germont. We have not seen him yet. He comes to meet Violetta, because as a bastard, he wants to tell her, stay away from my son, because I have a daughter. She's very pure, she's a wonderful girl. So you are a prostitute, stay away. Leave him alone. So he goes to meet Violetta with a terrible intention. So Verdi writes with the strings, pom, pom, tarim, pom, pom. And he says, Violetta Valerie, e c'è son io. D'Alfredo il padre, me vedete, you see in me the father of Alfredo, etc. Now, tim, pom, pom, tarim, pom, pom. Almost you have the picture of this man that is so, you say in English, triumphant? Pompous.
Pompous.
In Italian is tronfio. Tronfio. Pompous. Arrogant. Without any sensitivity. So Verdi with music tells you who is coming in and how he should walk. So he's not telling you he comes from the right door or he comes from the left of the stage, he comes from the back. That is not important. He doesn't tell you the way he should be dressed or this, but he's telling you with the music who he is. Violetta Valeri. I've seen a production of a great, in quotes, director. Nobody was on stage. Nobody. So the music goes, it's only Violetta doing something. And then, and then at the end of this phrase, Papa Germain comes in very quickly and very angry, walking very fast because he has to start to sing. So, and that Violetta Valeri, it's completely wrong. So this is a small example of how the music is important. I don't know why we have lost this normal, natural path.
The first big pianist that you worked with was Vyacheslav Richter.
First was Robert Casadesus. And then was Richter.
Mozart, Köchel 450, and Britten.
And Britten Piano Concerto.
Britten Piano Concerto. Si. And then he became the photographer at your wedding.
Si, bravo. They asked Richter, would you like to play with the young conductor? He said, if he's a good musician, why not? So that was his answer. But then a few weeks later, he sent me a message that he wanted to meet with me in Siena. This was in 1967. So I took my scores and I went to Siena. It was raining and was November. Everything was so melancholic and empty. I went to the Accademia Chigiana in Siena. I opened the door and I saw a big hall and two grand piano, not one. This huge gentleman, because Richter was like a giant, standing near a piano, and he said, please, sit here. He sat at the other piano, and he said, play. So we went through the Mozart concerto, from the beginning to the end. And as I said, I was a good pianist, and I could see from the corner of my eye that he was always looking at me with certain interest. That we finished the Mozart concerto, and then he said, now Britten. And we played the entire Britten concerto. And then in the end he stood up and he said to the translator to tell me, if he conducts the way he plays, he's a good conductor. So I accept to play with him. And that was my debut in Florence, and after this huge success, the orchestra asked me to become their principal conductor. I'm proud about this, the fact that in every orchestra I've been, I always was invited by the musicians, not by managers or presidents of artistic directors, etc., etc. In 1972, I made my debut with the Philharmonia Orchestra, at that time New Philharmonia. At that time was not the Henry Wood Hall and not the Barbican, didn't exist. So I had to go with the musicians to do a rehearsal in the morning in a Bishop's Gate, or in the afternoon at 2 o'clock in a church or in a school. I was very impressed by the English musicians. At that time, in the 72, it was a hard life. And the musicians asked me, because they were trying to find the successor of Klemperer, and Klemperer had retired 2 years before, so they didn't have a principal conductor. Before the concert, after the general rehearsal, the musicians, the committee, asked me if I was interested in becoming their principal conductor. And I asked for 3 months to think about it, because I thought London is really one of the capitals of the music in the world of music. There are so many orchestras, great conductors, chief conductors or visiting conductors. It's the center of the music world. I don't have the experience. I don't have the repertoire. I don't speak English except good morning and good evening with a bad pronunciation. So what I do here? But then I decided to accept. And it was very hard in the beginning. Every piece of Beethoven symphony or Brahms symphony, Tchaikovsky symphony, was new for me. And the orchestra was down artistically. No public.
You shouted a lot. Was that because you didn't have the language?
No, I didn't shout.
No, that's what the musicians say.
No. No, because it's not my style to shout. Mm-hmm. No, maybe my way of saying things was the translation in English of an Italian way.
It came over.
But shout, no. No. Shout is wrong, bro, mm-hmm. because in my life I've never. Mm-hmm. It's not part of my education. I can be very sharp. But, for example, I remember one time Christopher Bishop, that was a manager at a certain point, he said to me one day, he said, Maestro, you know, sometimes when the musicians ask for something and you say no, sometimes musicians are a little uncomfortable because it's no. But it's the way I speak.